Hi, my name is Joe DeNicholas. I've been a meditation practitioner for about 17 years. I've been teaching meditation for about 12 years. I got a degree in clinical social work and achieved full licensure here in Colorado. So I'm now an LCSW, and I've been doing therapy for about 6 years. And I'm sitting here with Gary Allen.
I'm the co-executive director of the Mindfulness Peace Project, and we teach prison inmates and military veterans meditation and also Buddhism. I teach Shambhala training, which is a program of how one brings meditation and spiritual principles into daily modern life. And I've been teaching Buddhist classes since the 80s.
Easy topic to get everyone's mind around, and that's a bit of a pun, the mind. So, Gary, when you talk about the mind, when you say the word mind, what do you mean by that?
Well, you can slice and dice it a lot of ways. I think at the outer level, it's the sense of being a perceiver, a thinker, an actor. You have a sense of subjectivity. I'm this particular person. This is my body. This is my situation. And you have the process of thinking and feeling and reacting to perceptions. And I think for most of us, that is dualistic idea. In other words, we have a fixed idea of that the mind is in me, and my mind is what experiences the bodily world, and that world is external to the mind. In other words, there is a solid objective world, and I'm a solid subjective perceiver of that world and one who interacts and reacts to it. So that's just everyday felt sense of what mind is. But from the point of view of meditative tradition then that I represent, then mind is a much more fundamental thing than that. We would normally feel like our minds, they get going, maybe we'd say in the womb, and we're born and start to identify, who we are and what we are, and we have this life, and then we die eventually, and, seemingly the mind will go away at that point. So we associate it with our body. But the non-dual view, meaning beyond subject and object, is that mind is underlying not just your particular life, but it underlies all phenomena, all apparent phenomena. Immediately you have the idea that if you look, you can see and get the idea that nothing you experience do you experience without mind. Like, it seems like the body is separable from the mind, but, subjectively, you're not going to experience any phenomena without the mind being there. Otherwise, frankly, you are dead. Your body, your senses don't function unless the mind is present. If you're in a deep sleep, for instance, there could be all kinds of things going on around you, but you are not going to notice them or know about them. Every single experience you have, you will only know through your mind. And what this is pointing to is that all phenomena are interdependent with mind and a part of mind, part of the fabric of mind. and looked at from a meditative point of view, then, well, what is that thing that we're calling mind? If you examine it, then it becomes hard to pin down. For one thing, it doesn't have an obvious location. You can't. In a normal Western view is that the mind is the brain, but we're talking about something much more fundamental than that, that there's the potentiality of consciousness and the potentiality of phenomena that comes before there's even a body and a consciousness that goes with that body. So there's an underlying sense that there's a ground of mind, and it is defined as emptiness or space and luminosity. So there's a basic space to reality. There's a space that everything takes place within. There's a space your thoughts take place within. There's a space that the physical world takes place within. And then there's a sense of mind, but it's not that it's not a dead space. It's not a void space, but that it's imbued or inseparably with a capacity to cognize or perceive and, or know, and a quality also of display or expression or energy. So within that space, there's an ability to know, and there's something to be known. There's appearances, phenomena that arise and subside that are recognized and understood. But if you take away the normal idea of what a subject and an object is, then from this point of view, both the subject and the object arise from the mind. And they are both products of the mind. If you look for a fundamental mind, like you can't find it as a location, like the brain. If it's not, you know, in some vast set of servers or stored somewhere in Denmark or something. There's no, you look for it, it's not there. And yet there's this ability to cognize, and there is this play of phenomena.
So with respect to that dualistic approach, you know, it's not really our fault being in this generation, because from the West, you know, thought leaders from Aristotle to Galileo, and then Rene Descartes, the thought leaders of the West have kind of taken us down this path. And so, you know, just as another analogy to help people understand what we mean by dualism, a lot of people are believing that their mind is essentially based in their brain, which is like a CPU, a central processing unit, and it has sensors that are feeding that processor. So like your eyeballs are like a camera, and they feed information into a brain that is some kind of objective observer. And that's what's meant by dualism, is effectively reality is happening to us. We're not co-creating anything. We're not even actually participating in the creation of reality. We're the objective observer of it. And that already doesn't make sense, because when you know, everyone thinks there's a...
We're not terribly objective.
Right. And then that's what, you know, when you get into like Dr. Andy Clark, and he wrote a great book called The Experience Machine. that you're basically living the thing you call reality, this experience that you're having, is your mind's best guess of what it thinks might be going on and what it thinks is going to happen next. Like when you drink water and you have your thirst quenched immediately, none of that water is in any of your cells. It's in your stomach. Yet you have the immediate experience of having your thirst quenched because your brain is just saying, based on the models I have from history, I have currently a model of the body and the model of the water. I now believe I have enough water and I'm good. So I don't need you to keep drinking. So I'm going to quench your thirst.
So you're saying that there's a biological bias automatically, like a biological habitual way of perceiving?
We're getting to the point in the West in neuroscience to say that it's almost nothing but that. You're basically living in your grooved patterns. Which is very fascinating because the East has been saying this for a very long time. And now we're waking up to this. But, you know, the fact of the matter is there is no line between you and the world. Everyone thinks that the boundary is at the skin line. But if you zoom in there or look with different wavelengths of light, like X-rays or stuff, it's like if we only looked with X-rays, we would say the line between us and the world is at our bones. And we don't actually even have a brain. Right? Like you would draw, if you looked in a different way or a different level of magnification, you would be having a totally different experience and you would define yourself totally differently.
And kind of no matter what sensation you experience, your mind has to register the experience. And at what place does the body end and the mind begin in terms of actual experience?
At what place? Say that again.
So in term, just take anything, like you're feeling the surface of a table with your fingers. If your mind is not taking that in at whatever level, you have no experience of feeling that, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're noticing it, and you're paying attention, you're putting your fingers on the table, you're running them across it. Where does the mind experience, where does the physical experience stop and the mind experience begin?
Mm-hmm.
That's a fundamental distinction that once you examine it, you can't really say.
Right, the whole thing collapses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can directly experience that this whole dualistic thing. But that was the problem. Is Descartes, you know, stopped at, I think, therefore I am. He didn't keep going like the Buddha did. Like, well, what's behind thought? And what's making that?
Well, it always seems like an incredible assumption. I think, therefore I am. You're laying in bed at night, and you're tired. Maybe you're thinking about the day, and you start to drift away. If you pay attention, you're still thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy neurotic. Well, who's thinking at that point? And who's thinking at any point? Like, once you start to look for the source of the thought, it's a lot less obvious where that source might be. And we just say, well, it's in my brain. Or is it? And the thoughts themselves have no substance. You can measure brain waves and neurological activity, but you're still measuring the brain. You're not measuring the thoughts. So where are the thoughts? And, you know, show me what a thought is. But you can't do that. Only someone can tell you, you know, I'm having this thought or I'm having that thought. So what, you know, where is the origin of that thought really?
Well, it's by the same token, where is color, right? Because I'm looking at a blue wall right now, but the wall, the atoms, the nuclei are not blue. The blue is the mind's hallucination, or it's just how it presents a certain phenomena occurring when you put certain photon movement or photons and electrons move between shells and they produce photons and those hit a retina and it turn into electricity, blah, 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 blah. You can describe the physical process all day long, but find blue in there. It's just, you can describe electricity, but so what? Where's blue? It's just that's what the mind does. It's the whole thing is a hallucination. And that's what's really strange in that same book, Experience Machine, but from Andy Clark. Like, when you're dreaming, it's pretty obvious that it's all a hallucination. There's nobody sitting across from you at lunch. You're not eating an actual hamburger. The other person with you is actually your version of who your friend is, right? And what Andy Clark is saying is when you're awake, having an experience, it's all the exact same circuitry, the same electricity firing in the same exact ways. It's just there's a little bit of data being accepted to say, like, hey, eyeballs, tell me if the experience I'm presenting to this person's mind, tell me if I'm way off, and then I'll adjust the hallucination for them. But if I'm not way off, I don't actually care what you have to say. And so that's why it can be really difficult. Like if you're driving down the road in Colorado at 5 a.m. on a foggy morning and you see like this four-legged thing, you're not thinking, your mind has no priors to say that that's a zebra. And it will take you a long time to figure out to actually see the zebra because it's so counter, like there's zero chance that that's a zebra. But if it actually is a zebra, it would take an overwhelming amount of data coming in to say, holy cow, that actually is a zebra. So the mind is fundamentally producing experience from this open state. Is that what you refer to, or what Buddhists would refer to as emptiness? That there's just this creative process happening out of thin air, essentially?
Yes.
And then what is luminosity by that?
That's the... That's why there's a creative process. So it's just like anything else. Like if you're going to paint a picture, there's got to be an open canvas, right? There's got to be some space there that you put the paint on to form the images. So that's that fundamental space is considered unconditional. In other words, it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't become anything like the space of a room. You can put all kinds of furniture in it. You can take them all out. You can rearrange it. And the space stays the same. It just the forms occupy it in different ways. So, but the capacity is what is called luminosity. The Tibetans have a word, usul, which means clear light, saying there is a clear light nature to all phenomena. And it's not, it's a natural quality or natural way that the space displays itself. So then you, out of habit, interpret it one way or the other. And it depending on how, what you're locked into, you know, like like if you have a human body, you have, you know, generally see what human senses see. And if you have a fly's body, then you have compound eyes and you see all these different reflections or all these different angles on things. So then your consciousness becomes that form. And then you have the condition, like human beings would have the conditioning of their culture and their society. You know, this is what's important. This is what's not important. This is what we value. We don't even pay attention to these things over here. And you go to a different culture and it's different than that. So you get shaped to see accordingly.
Why don't I experience that freedom? Why does it feel so grooved? Like, because what we're describing here sounds like the mind is this all-creating sovereign that gets to that can create whatever reality it wants in a way. But that's totally counter to my experience as a human. It feels very, very fixed.
There's a web of cause and effect. So, and you're part of that web of cause and effect. So based on what came before, you know, there's a situation that you have now. And based on what happens now, you have a situation that will come unfold in future or shift how it appears now into something else.